Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
July 21st, 2019, and welcome to episode 197 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and watching your language. That's right, we're going to talk about language, so watch your language, you two, or watch your languages, I should say. I got two other guys with me here because, you know, I couldn't figure out how to kick them out of Skype, so we'll start with Jack Nutting. Jack, how are you, sir?
Hey, Earl, I'm doing pretty good. And we were talking before about Swedish, and hey... means hi in Swedish. You just say hey, just like we say hey, and it means hi, hello. But they also have, they have their word for good day, which is a single word pronounced good dog, which sounds a lot like good dog to me. People are saying good dog, good dog.
It does, but that's an easy way to remember it.
Yeah, people like their dogs, so hey, good dog.
Very nice. See, the RCR doesn't just bring you bits and bytes. We bring you culture.
That's right.
We are a cultured group.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then there's Carrington. Hello, Carrington.
Hello.
So.
Hello.
So how are you? You were talking about a musical that you liked before we started recording.
Oh, yeah. I still go on and on about Be More Chill. I'm still hooked on it. It's a musical basically by kids and for kids and whatever. I'm old, but I like it anyway.
Hey, you can. Nobody can tell you what to like. So
yeah, you can't tell me what to like.
And we all like to be more chill. At least I do. I was saying before we started, this last couple of weeks has been kind of crazy at work, so I could stand to be more chill. So I'm going to go see that musical, I think. But before I do that, I'm going to start us out with a host topic. And I don't even know who picked this topic, but it's a great one. Apparently, it is inspired from an article that was on Y Combinator. And we'll have a link to that up in the show notes. But the question, the big question for you guys is, what old, in quotes, old programming language will you still be using this year? So I'm going to start with you again, Jack. So tell us, are you going to be doing any programming at all this year? And if you are, what old language would you be using?
Well, I'm going to be doing programming because that's what I'm doing all the time. And most of what I'm doing is in Swift, but there's still like some of the tools around Swift are written in Ruby, which is starting to qualify as an old language in the sense, I mean, it's 20 plus years. It's been around, I think. I think it's from the mid 90s. But beyond that, also just C. Like, I don't do a lot of C, but there's still C to be done now and then. There's always software that's going to be brought up to new platforms, and chunks of it are written in C, and you got to figure out how to make it work, how to bring some old thing into your new paradigm. So some C for sure. And as I say every time we talk about this, I'm aiming to do some more 6502 assembly, just because I enjoy what I've done so far, and I think it'll be fun to learn more of it. So that's definitely not anything I'll be doing for any professional capacity, or, you know, it's just for fun, for my own nerding out.
But the C work, you're saying if that happens to come up, might be in a professional mode, or is that just for fun also?
It definitely can be. Like, sometimes there are things where we're going to use, you know, use some kind of library that exposes its innards as a set of C functions and enums and that sort of thing. So it's there is sometimes work involved in wrapping some of these things in one way or another to use them from some other language. So like in general, that doesn't entail a lot of C programming, but like, I don't know. I feel like I've also spent so many years doing Objective C, which is kind of an object-oriented layer on top of C, it always is C. It's C plus more stuff, you know, just like C++ is also C plus more stuff, just a different C plus more stuff. So I don't know. I think like I don't think anybody's going to escape C for a very, very long time entirely. There are so many systems that are written in whole or in part in C that everyone's using every day. So yeah, that's going to be around for a long time, but I guess I for sure do less and less programming in C all the time, but it never seems to totally go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And it's also real big in the Internet of Things, microcontrollers, little gadgets.
Sure.
They all tend to have a lot of C or C++ involved in programming, like Arduino, for instance.
Right.
C and C++.
Yep.
So yeah, those things aren't going away anytime soon, which I think is awesome.
A friend of mine was talking about some other Internet of Things development that's done with a very not old language, which is Elixir. Have you heard anything about this?
I don't know of that one. No.
So Elixir is a fairly modern language, and if I'm not totally wrong on this, I think it runs on top of the Erlang sort of VMs. So it's a thing where you can like have a ton of things going on at once, like a ton of threads, and the threads are cheap and threads communicate with each other quickly and easily. But the Erlang language, which was also invented here in Sweden, is apparently very tricky to use in the sense that it's very different from a lot of other languages. Whereas Elixir is more like it's a more modern syntax, a somewhat Ruby inspired syntax for accessing the same stuff. And someone told me that Elixir is being used for a fair amount of Internet of Things work. And I don't really know what that entails, but it kind of makes sense because Elixir is on top of Erlang. Erlang was written and designed, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago, basically to operate phone switching equipment. So to be able to handle a lot of data traveling back and forth across various inputs and outputs and switching things. And like, so all of Ericsson's old like phone systems were all built using Erlang internally. And so Elixir builds on top of that tradition somehow. So it's designed to be high performant and fault tolerant and able to sort of do some interesting things on the fly, which makes sense for Internet of Things. You're going to have a lot of small devices talking to each other and doing stuff. I'm going way off track here, but it's something.
No, that's cool. And I didn't actually realize that Erlang was that old. They had been around for that long. I mean, I kind of think of it as a new thing because it wasn't very long ago that I started hearing about it. But wow, way cool.
Yep, I think it's been around at least since the 80s, if not longer.
Huh.
Not 100% sure.
Now, these languages never go away.
Nope.
They just, if they've got some good stuff in them, then... look at the COBOL stuff that's still out there dealing with, probably still 90%+ of the financial transactions that go on these days. And it's just sitting there running. I mean, I don't know if anybody knows how it works anymore, but luckily it still does work.
Hopefully somebody does.
I hope so. Well, Carrington, what about you? What old languages are you going to be using this year?
My answer, I think, would be very similar to Jack's. In fact, I started thinking about this, and at first I thought, okay, like, these are the older languages. But the more I thought about it, I think Swift is the only not old language I'll be using. Languages seem to be all incredibly old. I just hadn't realized how old most of the things I do are. Like, I still do a bunch of stuff in C, even for work, just for the exact same reason Jack does. Like, more Objective C, but straight old ANSI C comes up frequently. And I've been doing C stuff, like... just not just as a hobby, but like professionally since like mid 80s, I think, or at least late 80s, getting paid for it. So like that's a super old language. But things like PHP, been doing PHP for at least 20 years, and I just forget about it being, it doesn't seem that old a language, but it's got to be at least from the early 90s. I've been using it since mid or late 90s, I think. And then stuff like Bash, like shell scripts, which is also programming. I just don't really think of it as programming, but doing shell things, like in my case, more Bash than other shells, but whatever, that seems to have been around forever. So when I think about it, I think I'm only using old languages, but I think the spirit of the question more is like kind of what, in a sense, what dead languages are you, like what Sanskrit equivalent are you still using? And I think there again, my answer is the same as Jack's. Like the one I'm hoping to use is 6502 assembler. And I'm not going to be using that for anything modern, just as a hobby thing. I still desperately want to get good at that. I've dabbled and done almost nothing. It still calls to me. So it's silly that I haven't sat down and tried to bash stuff out in that. So I think in a professional capacity, it's going to be Objective-C and C and PHP and JavaScript. That's another old one I use all the time and hate it still. Hated it day one, hate it today. I'll no doubt hate it tomorrow, but it stays around. So like all the web stuff, front and back end things, of course, and all that's relatively old. But Objective-C is really the only Swift is the only new thing I'm really using, both for fun and hobbies. But assembler, 6502 specifically, assembly language. That's the thing. That's the hole in my skill set that I wish I was better at. I wish I put more time into. I regret not doing so. And hopefully the coming year, if we address this question again a year from now, hopefully my answer will be different. And I'll say, hey, look at this game I made finally in assembler. So I should get off my butt and do that, because I've been answering this sort of question, I think, since the beginning of RCR. My answer has always been the same. And it's kind of silly. I haven't done something about it. So there you go. What about you, Earl? What old stuff are you doing old stuff in?
Well, so I'm going to give a split answer, I think, because I think you're right, Carrington, that, you know, if the goal here is to talk about what not really mainstream, but old language will I be using for fun, then I think you hit on the answer in the show notes. You kind of cheated there and teed it up for me, but it'd be fourth for me. And there are fourth implementations for some of the new stuff too. Like there are a couple of really good fourth interpreters that are out there, fourth implementations for the Propeller microcontroller. That's kind of a, you know, the Propeller isn't as mainstream, obviously, as some of the chips that you see in the Arduino and other things like that, but it's still an extremely fun multi-core microcontroller to work with. And there's a couple of really good, really fast fourth implementations for it. So probably playing with that as well as fourth again on some of the old systems, Apple, Atari, Commodore. I've wanted for a long time to find what is the best fourth for a PDP-11 and run that. But it seems like when I go looking, I can't quite figure out what is the implementation that would be best for the particular PDP-11 that I've got. So I don't know what I'm going to do there, but so fourth's the answer there. But so just in terms of mainstream, though, like might get paid for work kind of thing, got a question for you. Does 28 years old count as an old language? What do you think?
I think so. Sure.
All right. If that's the case, then Python. Because, you know, Python right now seems to be what all the cool kids are playing with. But Python's also from 1991. So it's been around just about stinking forever. And, you know, I'm not exactly sure why this is happening, but Python is just catching fire. It's just...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do lots of stuff in Python and get asked to do stuff in Python more than Ruby, for me anyway.
Yeah, I mean, AI and big data analysis and, you know, there's a whole web framework for it called Django that I've never played with, but I hear is pretty cool. Or if you just want to throw out a one-off script. See, one of my old favorite languages was Perl.
I was about to say the same thing. Yep. I still dig it. I still prefer Perl to all these other things.
Love doing Perl. You know, it's some people joke that Perl is a write-only language because it's so terse. And, you know, but, I mean, so much can be accomplished in just 10 lines in Perl. It's almost scary. So I'm finding that to a certain extent, Python is kind of now carrying that torch Like if you want to do some scripting, some automation, some text processing, stuff like that, Python seems to be the deal. So
yeah, for me, Perl and PHP are more my go-to languages for that sort of thing, just because of familiarity, because I've done so much in both of those, that just feels really comfortable. When I'm asked to do stuff, it's generally in Python. So I'm like, oh, okay, fine. It's like, that's what Stack Overflow is for. I can muddle through.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how we lived before we had Stack Overflow, but we did. But
very
now
poorly.
That it's there, man, I don't ever want to get along without it. So.
Yeah, because I desperately need somebody to ask the exact same question that I have and somebody else to post, oh, I've got the answer for that, but then not post the actual answer and then some mod to close the thread. I love it. Can't live without it. It's awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
He said, seething.
Exactly. Or to say, this question is a duplicate, but the question that you find isn't exactly a duplicate. So, yeah, it's got its downsides, but come on, man. It's a good resource.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, any other comments on languages? Because we've got other stuff to talk about, too, if you guys want to.
Let's do it. Well, onward.
All right. Fine. Well, Carrington, you're first. Tell us about TwoVision.
Backward. So I've got three things that I know very little about. Welcome to Carrington on RCR. So these are all recently released goodies, two of which are on GitHub. And they caught my eye because they're very cool and they're Apple things. So I'm going to lump them all together as one release overview. And maybe in the next episode, when we've got Paul back and people that were at Kansas Fest where I wasn't, they will know more about these things and then can give us more of an update. But I want to sneak in at least news of their release. So the first is TwoVision, which is version 0.2. That makes you want to install it. And it's cool. It's streaming video and audio for the Apple II. So it's a transcoder. You run it on, it's got to go on an actual Apple II, will not work on emulators as far as I know, because it requires an Ethernet 2 card. And like the release notes say for this, I don't think that is currently available in any emulators. So if you've got an actual 6502 running machine, it's been tested on a GS, but probably would work on earlier ones. You need an Ethernet 2 card, then you run this thing. And what it does is give you streaming video. Like it'll transcode on the fly stuff like .mp4 files, and you can watch the videos on your GS, which is just crazy. It can do full screen about 8 frames a second or so, but that's bonkers. Very, very, very cool.
That
so it's available
amazing.
On GitHub. I know, right? Like who would have thought this could be a thing? So pretty amazing. And if you don't do audio, then you can get quite a bit more video out of it, I think, because you know the GS is really struggling to keep up with this kind of stuff. But you end up, and I think they say somewhere between 50 and 100 kilobits a second is being written out to the high-res screen. So that's pretty cool. Anyway, that's just neat. Another thing that I think would exist. So that is out. We'll have a link to that in the show notes if you want to grab the stuff from GitHub. And like I said, it's at version 0.2, but still neat that it works at all.
Hey, can I ask you a question? I don't know if you know the answer to, but can you still get Ethernet cards?
Can I still get them?
Can anyone still get them? Can you like go out and buy one? Is that a thing?
It's a thing that exists in the world, but I don't know if they're... Can you go right on to like A2 Heaven or whatever and buy one?
That's
or
what
is
I mean.
It something you have to
get
to use
like
one?
Through one of the retro stores.
I'm going to say, Earl, for you, yes.
Perfect.
For you,
once
my friend.
Once again, the
yes.
internet caters to me. I love it.
Of course it does. So the second thing we got is also on GitHub, but it's version 1.0, so it's the first public release. Very cool. And it's something called NetDisk. So NetDisk is a way to mount remote disks on your Apple II. So things like disk images out on the Internet Archive. In fact, it has an archive.org disk browser. So it's basically letting all those disk images out there on the Internet now be as if they're just right in your Apple II. I know less about this. First public release came out. I think it looks really cool, but I've yet to download anything or look at it or try it at all. So I just know that something called NetDisk exists. And it's for the Apple II, and I'm very keen on it, but I know nothing else. Do either of you guys know anything about this? If Paul was here, he'd know, but I know nothing.
Yeah, I do not, but it looks really cool. It looked like just a really smart idea. Just like, man.
I don't know about
really
it, but I do want to say I think the link to the disk images on archive.org is genius. I mean, there's a similar set of hardware and software and internet connectivity you can do with the Commodore 64 that will allow you to mount a disk directly over the internet. But to my knowledge, it doesn't have any kind of link to the archive.org stuff. Them doing this for the Apple II is just amazing.
I think so too. And so there's a thing called NetDisk, and then there's separately this thing called Disk Browser, which basically just browses disk images on archive.org and then mounts them on your GS. Just very, very cool. Both from Shenmue, both available on GitHub, so we'll have a link to that. Now, let's say that's too much work for you, like having to sit there and, oh my goodness, I have to click buttons or whatever to bring the Internet Archive to me on my computer. I think that's way too much work. Well, then you might be interested in Total Replay. And this is the thing that came out of Kansas Fest that has blown my mind. So it's a collaborative process or project between 4AM and Cucumber, who obviously, you know, you put those two together and it's like, oh, what's coming out next? So this is called Total Replay, and it is literally hundreds of games, more than 200 games for the Apple II, all bundled together in you can just like download this and open it into your archive, and there you go. It has smart searching. Everything has been cracked. Everything has been changed to run on ProDOS and on a hard disk. So all these things that you normally would have had to take one off disk images and try to run, and are they cracked or are they not cracked? Here it is. It's like 200 and something, 203, 204, something like that, games, all just working, has an attract mode that just runs when you're not playing, which, like they say, is now the world's greatest 8-bit screensaver, because it's just attract mode from hundreds of Apple II games. Don't have to go off into the internet to get it. Don't have to worry about what's cracked, what's not cracked, what's going to run on a hard drive, what's not going to run on a hard drive. It's just like, download this one blob. Here you go. 203 games at your fingertips with a complete search mode. It's crazy amazing, like just unbelievable. Just released at Kansas Fest. I'm super, super excited about it. Runs on any Apple II with at least 64K of RAM, which is pretty low. Some of the games themselves require 128K. But again, that's a pretty low barrier, and you can run it on an actual Apple II or an emulator, and it's blowing my mind. So if you've got like a CFFA 3000, then this is the disk image to stick in that, and now your Apple II just boots to hundreds of games with a crazy cool attract mode menu.
And it says that you need some sort of mass storage, which makes sense, in order to do this.
Yeah, because it's such a big thing. Like, this wouldn't fit on a floppy. It's like a 32 meg file or whatever, because it is basically a hard drive image. So you'd want to stick it. And nowadays, most people do. You'd have a CFFA card or an SD card thing, like something that will act as a bigger storage thing for your actual Apple II, or just use this disk image in an emulator.
Very nice.
Ah, it's amazing. It's amazing. I'm super, super keen. It's crazy bonkers and very exciting. So this is one of the most exciting things to come out of Kansas Fest this year. And I wasn't there. Boo.
Cool. All three of those things are actually really cool and really amazing. I am very impressed by this Hall of Apple II stuff.
I'm very impressed every year by the Hall of Apple II stuff. It's crazy that this is the middle of 2019 and some of the most amazing things that have ever been created for the Apple II have been created this year. Like, what's taking so long is the question that people want to know. Where was this stuff in the late 80s?
Just 40 years to get to this?
Well, in Kansas.
Well, I guess in the late 80s, having a 32 meg mass storage device for your Apple II would have been very expensive.
Yeah, that would have cost a couple bucks.
Yeah. So anyway, these are all new, cool releases. I'm excited about it all. The Apple II is alive and well and exciting.
Awesome. And Kansas Fest, I was going to say, is a great venue for releasing this kind of stuff. Kind of a nice annual, you know, touch point that people can work to put out this super cool stuff.
Yeah, I hear good things. I should go.
All right, well, I got the next one, and if you were wondering why we didn't have listener feedback this time around, well, we kind of do. We had one listener feedback in the notes, and I stole it as a news item. This is really cool. Bob emailed us and let us know about the full-sized version of the C64 that's coming out in December. So some of you might be familiar with the C64 Mini. It was a scaled-down kind of visual replica of the Commodore 64 with a built-in firmware-based Commodore 64 emulator. 64 games came with a joystick. C64 Mini really popular, you know, sold in some of the discount stores. And so there's just tons of them out there, really good reception for it. And they've been updating the firmware on a regular basis, fixing bugs and that kind of thing. So the company that does it has been really responsive, it seems like. So in December, they're coming out with a full-size version of this. Now, note that the Mini, the tiny little version, has what looks like a keyboard, but it doesn't work. But on the full-size one, it's going to have a working, functional keyboard. It will have emulation built into it for both the Commodore 64 and the VIC-20, and also just a game carousel mode, where you can pick your game and just jump in and go. And that is close to all I know about it at the moment. That's about all I think we've been able to figure out on the internet. Now, because the C64 Mini was a real product, actually came out and is super popular, I've got a good feeling that this full-sized the C64 won't be vaporware, that it actually will come out. The one thing that I will say is in the video that I saw in this, the promo video, they're definitely showing what looks like a 3D model, not an actual prototype or something like that. So, you know, that's one thing to think about. I don't know if we've seen a real prototype of this, but I could be wrong.
Especially if it's supposed to come out in 6 months.
Yeah, it seems like maybe there ought to be some prototypes to take a look at. But then again, maybe there have been, and I just haven't seen those reviews. So
maybe they're just going to take actual original 64s and gut them.
Well, I mean, you know,
he said,
half of the ones out there don't work anyway, so I guess that'd be one way to revive them. But anyway, you know, a couple other things that we do seem to know is that this looks like a Europe-only release in December. I don't see any information about buying these in the U.S. or in other parts of the world besides Europe. Also, another thing we don't know is how many USB ports, or at least I haven't been able to figure that out based on the information that's
there's
out
at
there.
Least one, though, because in the website about it, it says, and I think this is a good note, because much as I'm not a big C64 fan, this is what I would look for in a device like this. You can use a USB stick or whatever to load your own files and your own games. So it's not limited to the 64 games that come on it. You can program stuff, save your own files, and also load your own games and things onto it, making it an actual Commodore 64 alternative, I guess. So that's pretty cool. And since it's HDMI out, like that's a lot easier to work with than a retro computer.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's 720p resolution coming out of the HDMI port, same as what you have on the C64 Mini. And you will have at least, I'm sure, two USB ports, because one allows you to do what you just said, Carrington, load your own games or software, and the other one is used for the joystick. That's the same as the C64 Mini. The thing that people have complained about with the C64 Mini, though, is that since you don't have a third USB port, you can't have a USB flash drive and the joystick and a keyboard all connected at the same time, unless you get a USB hub, which you can do, and that's fine. But I'm just saying,
but would you want to use an external keyboard? Isn't the whole point to use this keyboard?
Well, that's true also, is that
otherwise just use an emulator.
Full-sized.
Or like a better computer.
well, I can answer that. There is no better computer. But so you're right, two USBs might be fine with this, since you will have an actual keyboard on this model. But still, it'd be kind of nice if there were more, but I guess we'll see. Mm-hmm. Like
in the notes for the software features, it does say it supports both 50 hertz and 60 hertz displays. Like they call it Europe and USA displays. So at least there's that. So even if it's European only, it probably has a switching power supply. And if it's supporting NTSC at 60 hertz, then that's going to be pretty easy to use in North America.
Yeah, I think there'll be a North American release. I don't think there's any doubt about it. I just don't know if it's going to happen in December, when they're saying that the first one's going to come out. Because I think there was a difference in the timeline with the C64 Mini between Europe and North America also.
So they've come out with the C64 Mini. Now they've come out with a regular size one. Are they going to finally come out with the giant C64?
I think so,
that
yes.
The public are clamoring for.
The full desktop version of the C64.
The C64 right. Maxi. Exactly.
So anyway, this will come out in December. It seems really exciting. I mean, one thing that seems exciting is the price, in that what they're saying is about £100, which I think translates to $140 US at the moment. And that is actually really awesome. You know, as you'll recall, years back, there was a full-size C64 kind of look-alike that came out from that company whose name eludes me at the moment, but that was kind of a sad story. Came out, some people got them, but then the champion of the company sadly passed away, and the company went away, and, you know, but when that came out, that cost a lot more than $140 US. I think it was maybe three times that. So having this at this price point, really super exciting. I, you know, hope it comes out. Can't wait to see it, actually. And once it comes out, then you can take it and you can put it alongside your full-size replica of the Atari 800 or the Apple II. Wait. You don't have that, do you?
Wait a minute.
Don't need that.
All right. Just had to get that in there. Sorry. Little dig. Kind of responding to Carrington.
I think we should have not just a little dig, like a big pit. And then we get all of these things together. You see where I'm going with this, Earl?
All right. Moving on. Jack, you have a item here that is noteworthy.
Yes, a noteworthy item.
Oh,
so our
oh my goodness!
Everyone's favorite old deceased computer science, Alan Turing, you know, famously was demonized by the British government for a long time for the illegal crimes of being homosexual and that sort of thing. Only recently was I feel like it's only a few years ago that they sort of overturned that and said, "Hey, we don't consider him a criminal anymore." And now, not only that, his face is going to be on the new 50-pound note, which is pretty exciting. It will come out in the end of 2021. And I guess the 50-pound note is not super widely used in England.
Because nobody can afford
right,
one.
It's too expensive. They cost 50 pounds. In the article, it says, the note was once described as the, quote, currency of corrupt elites, unquote. I guess, you know, the point being that people generally aren't walking around with a ton of these in their pockets. But it does say in the article that there are currently 344 million 50-pound notes in circulation. So it's not like there are just a couple. So anyway, I don't know who's on the face of the old one, but it will be replaced with new ones with Alan Turing. Kind of exciting.
I think that's really exciting. I think it's great for Britain to commemorate the contribution that he made to computing, the contribution that he made to the war effort, which is really a big contribution that he and his team made to cracking the codes. So, yeah, it's fantastic.
Bit of a missed opportunity, though. There's a bunch of binary on it. You'll see there's a little ribbon there with a string of ones and zeros. And it actually, if you convert it to decimal, it comes out to be 23061912, which is June 23rd, 1912, Turing's birthday. So that's kind of a neat thing. But they could have put the date that they did some nasty things to him, and that would have been a fun little one to undermine it. But whatever.
I think maybe his birthday is
yeah, it's nicer, but still, you know, still, it's a little upsetting. But I think this is cool, and he's like, you know, one of the greats, one of the many, and well deserved to be on a note. Why not? I dig it.
Very nice.
I like colorful money with neat things on it. Canada has that too. Looking at you, America.
Yeah, you know, when I've traveled around, I have to admit, our bills are kind of boring. If you're, you know, a collector of paper currency, then the U.S. currency doesn't. I mean, it's come a little ways in the past few years, you know, changed some of the design attributes of it. It's a little prettier, but I always did like the Canadian money. I think those are really beautiful.
Yeah, we got holograms and see-through windows and Braille and lots of fun stuff on our... Mostly, I think, to make it harder to counterfeit. Because, you know, it's so much in demand. but yeah, I like our money. I dig our money. Although, it's all the same size. Other countries have different sizes for different notes, which I think is even better than Braille. Be able to, like, size the bills. But I guess it's easier for tills and stuff to have a standard size for every bill. So I get that. I like the countries that shake it up a bit so I can tell when I move that, okay, the bigger ones are worth more, not just colors.
That's true. Although, you know, I mean, the point might be almost moot anyway in that paper money is becoming less and less a actual medium of exchange. I guess unless you're the, what did you call them, Jack, the corrupt elites?
Yeah, I think that's what they said. The,
that's redundant.
Yeah, the currency of corrupt elites. Yeah, the corrupt elites are walking around with 50-pound notes, all these wads of cash in their pockets.
I'm not saying bloody proletariat revolution is the solution to all our problems. I'm just saying it should be on the table.
Oh, man. And now we're on a watch list. Okay.
Like that. Join me. Join me on the list.
All right. Changing topics again in an emergency mode. Carrington, you've got the last item here. Tell us about Apollo.
This is cool. Of course, it's the anniversary of the moon landing. Very exciting. Those of us with bald heads, you know, we kind of look like the moon, so I'm excited about moon stuff. Moon stuff is awesome. So I've been following along, and I just love all that. And of course, then we talked last episode about the, or maybe two episodes ago, depending on when the mega podcast thing from Kansas Fest gets slipped into the feed. But in the last normal episode, we talked about the Apollo mission stuff, and just... I'm just excited about all of it. But anyway, a thing that comes up a lot, a thing that I have said, that probably a lot of people have said, is it's amazing that, you know, they put people on the moon with computers less powerful than our watches nowadays. And then, like, that's always the thing. It's like, oh my goodness, my home computer is more powerful than the thing that put people on the moon. My watch is more powerful. My phone is more powerful. My calculator is more, my toaster is more powerful, blah, blah, blah. We've all said that. And in a sense, it's kind of true when you just look at megaflops and such. But there's a great article that came out in the Atlantic in the science section that's like, no, specifically it says your smart toaster can't hold a candle to the Apollo computer. So it talks about the Apollo guidance computer. And yes, if you just look at memory size and calculations per second, computers we walk around with nowadays, and especially the computers on our desks at work, are vastly more powerful. But that's not the only way to evaluate the power of a computer. The power of a computer is what it can actually do. And the Apollo guidance computer, well, yes, being very limited in modern terms when it comes to RAM, when it comes to calculation speed, was able to communicate with dozens of different devices simultaneously, take in a ton of information, and imagine if it was running a factory. We said we just have this little computer, and it's going to connect to these 50 devices in real time and move them and all coordinate between them. And like, it was actually an incredibly powerful computer, even by modern standards. And it's something I never really thought of before, like the different ways to evaluate the power of a computer. And so this is an article just kind of re-looking at that. Because, you know, the Apollo 11 mission has hit the half-century milestone. And I thought this was really interesting because this is a thing I see all the time. You know, oh, it's, you know, my iPad is more powerful than the Apollo guidance computer. And so this is in defense of the AGC that it was much more powerful than we give it credit for. So it's maybe not that ridiculous that it was able to put people on another planet.
So are you saying that maybe just looking at the raw CPU spec or whatever, it would not be that impressive, but looking at throughput, what it could actually accomplish?
Yeah, exactly. And the capabilities of it, like the number of different hardware devices it could connect to in real time, and the way it could take data streams, make calculations, make decisions, and say, oh, wait, no, change that thruster, do this, and like all the different things it had to coordinate with. It's an incredibly, like, you know, dozens of thrusters and lots of different interfaces and a whole guidance platform and all of that. And it's actually a very capable computer, much more so than we kind of, in modern parlance, we often are dismissive of it. Like, oh, I can't believe they put people on the moon and my pencil is more powerful and blah, blah, blah. It was actually like an incredibly powerful computer. You just got to not just look at its, you know, megahertz.
That's interesting.
It's not all about the megahertz.
No. And I think, you know, in the days when things were starting to transition from mainframes to like mid-range systems, people would talk about the CPU capabilities or the RAM or whatever of the mid-range systems. And they go like, wow, you know, look what we've got compared to the mainframe. But on the other hand, the mainframe folks were saying, well, but look at all the transactions we can cram through this mainframe. You know, if you tried to cram that number of users, that number of transactions through your mid-range systems, they would just collapse. They just get crushed, yeah, basically. So,
and yes, a modern phone or a modern computer, like, could be made to do these things, but it's not like the phone in your pocket can't do that. Like, the Apollo Guidance computer was capable of taking a big device and sending it the 250,000 miles away and hitting a target within 500 feet as it's moving a 1/10 of a foot of a second. Okay, I'll give you a week. You do that with your phone. So it's like, no, you can't, because the Apollo Guidance computer wasn't just that bit. It was all these other devices all connected to it. Like, and so when you look at like how it's kind of an article, but how do you define what a powerful computer is? And it was an interesting look at that concept that I used to be quite dismissive of. I was just all about the, you know, how many transistors does it have or whatever. So
right, because you could
it opened my eyes to a different way to think about it.
You could replace the CPU with a new CPU that runs at 3 gigahertz, but it wouldn't really necessarily affect the operation of this device because there's so many more components around the CPU. It's kind of,
yeah,
like there's so much going on in like the architecture of the machine that is unique for this purpose that would be hard to replicate. Like, just looking at the photo in the article, you see Margaret Hamilton in this sitting in front of this control panel smiling at the camera, and on the control panel itself there are a few dozen switches and knobs of various sorts. And like, my immediate thought is, okay, if I was going to connect a few dozen switches, just toggle switches, simple toggle switches to my modern computer, like, I'm not even sure how I would do that in a straightforward way. You know, it'd be like, okay, I'll have to create some kind of USB device that can like break out a bunch of things and report them. You know, like they're sort of like, the architectures we have today are so commoditized and so like split up into discrete chunks. Here's what a computer is. Here's what an input device is. Whereas this was a single monolithic architecture built around taking in a whole bunch of inputs and producing a whole bunch of outputs to direct the thrusters and to do all these things and to show the astronauts what they needed to see. Like,
the funny thing is, like, I've inherently done this sort of thing, like considered something more powerful or more suitable when it had lesser specs many times. Like, being an Apple fan, like I was a big fan of the iPod when it came out, and people told me all the time, oh, I shouldn't get an iPod because look at this other thing. It's got a radio in it. It's got this, it blah, blah, all these other features. I'm like, I don't want those stupid features. It doesn't work as well. This thing's going to give me, you know, like they said, 5,000 songs in my pocket and with a port that's going to stream. Like, this is a better device. This is, in my sense, a more powerful music device than your thing that has a radio and an SD card that is incredibly slow to use and whatever. This one is better. It's more powerful for its task, in a sense. And so I've done that myself many times in making purchasing decisions and what's the right thing for me. And yet I still was, you know, the kind of hypocrite I often am. And I was very dismissive, sure, of all the space stuff from the 60s. Oh, it was so weak. And so the article was a kind of a good wake-up call to my own hypocrisy when I was evaluating the power of a computer, because a computer isn't just a CPU. It's a whole thing.
Right.
And it's a really good article.
It had to do things in real time. I mean, if I get on my phone, like we're comparing it to the phone, right? If I get on my smartphone and I bring up YouTube and my phone is laggy for some reason, then I just don't get YouTube quite as fast. But if this...
Versus the moon and three guys crash.
Under the lunar surface, you know, because my real-time computer was laggy. The other thing is, you know, if I drop my phone 4 feet onto the carpet, I'm scared that when I pick it up, maybe it's not going to work. This thing had to go through the mechanical shock of a Saturn V takeoff. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, no way that a lot of just mainstream electronics would have put up with that amazing amount of G-force and inertia and vibration and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, very good point. So all this stuff was, I don't know, it's a good article that really made me think of things differently. So I want to bring it to other people's attention, because I'm not the only person who has been dismissive of like the 1960s space tech and like, oh, it's, you know, my thumbnail is so much more powerful and blah, blah, blah. And so this was a good wake up call for me that I was kind of misjudging what computer power really means. And it's been a while since I read an article that really made me think, oh, hold on, let me reevaluate. I have been wrong.
Yeah. So take that, whippersnappers.
Snap your whippers elsewhere.
All right. Well, we have some upcoming shows that we mentioned from time to time, and this will be one of the times. One of them is VCF West, coming up August 3rd and 4th in Mountain View, California. We'll have a link in the show notes. Another is Fujiyama 2019, which we were yakking about before we started recording. That's in Lengenfeld, Germany, August 26th through September 1st, and we might have an RCR representative going to one or two of those days. Ajax?
Yep, I'm thinking more and more strongly about it. I'm leaning towards that I'm going to go. I was looking this morning, figuring how the heck do I get there? I think I have to fly somewhere and then take a train, but it's, I don't know. It's not easy to know. I'll figure it out.
Well, you're closer than we are. We've got a whole
Definitely.
Ocean to get across. That's not going to stop Kevin Savitz, but he'll be there too. And, of course, Tandy Assembly 2019 in Springfield, Ohio, September 27th through the 29th. So this is awesome. You can go out and meet some of your retro buddies. And at this point, a word from our sponsor.
A tape of this quality deserves to be played in the most sophisticated of systems. Because Sony Premium Tape has more music, where other tapes have distortion and hiss. Sony Audio Tape. It's the closest you can get to music.
And hey, we're back. And we've got an idea. Right? And we have a...
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Sure,
thank
definitely.
You.
We can have an idea.
We can. You know, at least one per show. This one is for a retro computing gift, and it's awesome. This is for a Sony boombox. So before you ask, I'm going to say, yep, they still make portable cassette players with handles, and they still call them boomboxes. You can still walk down the street in your shiny sweats. You can take one of these, rest it on your shoulder before you set it on the ground and break dance.
Amazing.
This is amazing to me that they still make them with cassettes and that they're still actually called boomboxes. Like, you go to the Sony site and they have radios, clock radios, boomboxes. Like, that's the actual category. And they got like CD/cassette boombox. Like, it's amazing. And multiple models.
And they have one that has Bluetooth. It has CD and radio and USB and Bluetooth, but not cassette.
Nah, you gotta get a cassette.
I want
one.
The cassette and the Bluetooth. That's what I want. That's the combo for me.
Me too.
Indeed. So, you know, you can party like it's the 80s. Now, I mentioned breakdancing, but, you know, perhaps at our age we should be cautious about this.
And break a hip dancing.
Exactly. I think the only thing I'm going to break is my ankle. Of course, I couldn't breakdance back in the day either, so no big loss. But this would be fun. And, you know, I don't have to buy one, though, because I still have a Sony boombox in my garage. So if I want to take that baby and rock out in the park, I can do it.
Nice.
Very cool.
It does have CD also, but it does have not just one, but dual cassettes with double speed recording mode. You remember those?
Oh, yeah.
Like if you
make
want to, you know,
more quickly.
Make
you
your
pirate
R cassettes, then you could do it at double speed.
I'm looking at the one of these that I really like, and I love the fact that it's such old school design on these. They all have like physical buttons, not touchscreens, and like big chunky buttons in a lot of cases for the cassette part, which is very cool. They come with 3 tuner presets for the radio, because why would you want more than those, which is awesome. The CDs nowadays on these can play MP3s, but I'm just all about the cassette on this. And in case you're wondering if they can still go portable, not just plug in, yes, of course, it takes 6 C-size batteries. So they even have stayed old school with the batteries. Love it.
Nice.
Wow, which triples
the weight.
4.5 pounds.
Yeah, see, 4.5 pounds without batteries. Oh, that's great. I love these things.
Oh, man.
Well done, Sony.
Yes.
They must
yes,
just
indeed.
Have a bunch of these lying around. They're like, well, I guess we still have them. Let's keep them on the website.
Thank you for catering to us, Sony. And we're giving you a free shout out. No sponsorship required.
Nope.
All right. Now we can talk about other things to buy on eBay. Carrington, you've got the first one. This has not just, it isn't just an awesome item, but it's got an awesome name.
It does, because I think it's named after Kevin Savitz's dog, because it's a Gigi. So I know nothing about this thing. It's 1975 computer by Deck Digital, the VK100 Gigi graphics terminal. says it's working, looks like a Coco in a lot of ways. Like, it's a really cool industrial design that, to my eyes, looks kind of like modern in 1980s terms. And I don't know anything about this thing. Like it doesn't look like a terminal. Certainly doesn't look like anything I would have thought would come out of digital. So do you guys know what the Gigi is?
I've never encountered this. Don't know a thing about it. I think it's super cool.
I do recognize, looking at the back panel, it's got a set of four of these round connectors. I don't know what they're called. I remember seeing these in like some weird high-end screens at college.
When you get the like three or four round connector thingies.
It's like RGB and sync or something like that.
Oh, yeah. BNC connectors. Yeah, it looks like it's got separate RGB BNC connectors. Yep, I've got that on one of the deck monitors that I have. Yeah. Probably plug into this.
Yeah, so I don't know. Like, it's a terminal, it says, but it's a graphics terminal. So, I don't know. Paul should be here. Paul knows these things. Paul knows all. It's really cool. So when I looked at it, I'm like, this doesn't look like something by Digital. It looks like something by Tandy, except the coloring's kind of wrong. It's really neat looking, and I dig it. Will I buy it? No, I will not. It is very expensive. They want to buy it now of $2,000, but there's a make offer. So somebody could make an offer other than me, I guess. I dig it, but if you're looking for a Tandy or the Deck Gigi, never seen one before, and now is your chance.
Well, the keyboard is very VT100. In fact, let me just pivot my chair here. Yeah, it's like exactly VT100, actually. I'm holding up a VT100 keyboard right now, right next to this. Looks identical. So, so this missing keycap that they have, if you happen to have a non-working VT100 keyboard, I wonder if the keycaps would be compatible. Anyway, very cool.
Yeah.
Very nice. What else you got, Carrington?
I've got something that I have not seen before and kind of can't see now because it's clear. It is a clear case, a total see-through case, Apple IIe enhanced. So this came up on on eBay a couple of weeks ago by Vintage Micro saying, okay, they've created these clear cases and they're testing the interest in it. And it got listed for like $3,000, $3,500, something like that. Didn't sell, got relisted for $1,500 or something like that and got snatched up immediately. Seems to be listed again, so they must have a few of these. And it's listed for $15. So $1,515.15. Buy it now. No make an offer. That's the price. But it is, imagine an Apple IIe, just like a normal Apple IIe, except the case, completely see-through. A completely clear case. Looks very cool. Looks a little weird because the keyboard is still solid. So the floating kind of yellowed keyboard on it looks a little weird to my eye. I think I'd pick a different color or something. But it's a really neat case. Like, this is something very, very cool. Would I spend $1,500 on an Apple IIe? No, I would not. But somebody else out there might. I don't know. It's neat. Certainly neat to look at. Definitely worth hitting the links to look at the pictures. Have you guys seen this thing? Do you know anything about these people making these clear cases?
No, first I've seen it, but it's very cool.
Yeah.
I love it.
So I don't know who bought the first one, but I dig it a lot. At Kansas Fest this time, I was watching the photos and things on Twitter, and there were some photos of Macintosh classics that had been painted up. So in a sense, they were color classics, but not, you know, color classics. And I just really like it. Like, I love the original colors of everything, but sometimes things get like super yellowed or whatever and they look ugly, and when somebody then paints it a big lime green, I'm like, you know what, that looks great to me. And this is another alternative. Now, I think I would be just as happy with a, you know, bright fuchsia Apple II, and I could probably make that a lot cheaper than $1,500. But these are very cool cases. Like, it's an actual Apple II case as if it's X-rayed. So it's hard to look away from. It's so cool looking. It's just a lot of money, but probably quite expensive to make these things. So I don't think it's necessarily too much money. I have no idea what's involved in making it. It's really cool. It's just out of my price range.
It must be the fabrication costs, because that is a stinking lot of money. I mean, I love this visually. I think this is awesome. I would love to have one, but I don't $1,515.15 want to have one.
Me too. And the third thing I have, because I'm trying to go full Paul here, is I don't know if you guys know the data access language. So we talked at the beginning of the show about old languages we might be still using. This isn't one I used then, so it's not one I'm using now. And it was data access language, or DAL, D-A-L, was like an SQL sort of language by Apple, released in 1990, to do client server stuff to database management systems. I've never even heard of this before. According to Wikipedia, it was quite famous for its poor performance and incredibly high cost. So I'm like, oh, that probably went over like a lead balloon, which may be why I never heard of it before. So I've never encountered this. But on eBay at the moment, for $50, is an 8.5-inch reel of something called Operation Dalicious, which I guess is some sort of DAL program or teach you about it, or is it the actual DAL language? I don't know, but it's an 8.5-inch reel, and I'd never heard of DAL before, and this is part of Operation Dalicious. Somebody must know what this is, and for $50, it can be yours.
Wow.
Yours, Earl. Do it.
Well, $50 for the reel, and then, you know, probably 500 or more for the reel data, the tape deck, actually.
And then all the computer client server infrastructure, and then you can have a notoriously bad language. But it all begins here.
Sold.
From not really pitching it well. I mean, I was considering it, but, you know, with that explanation, I'm punching the buy it now.
It's just one of those things where I don't know. Like, I it flew under my radar completely. So this is a whole Apple language that I'd never even heard of before. Other people probably know all about this, but just this is something that I had never heard of. So the DAL, I guess I just wasn't dealing with Apple client server stuff in the early 90s at all. I don't know. I don't know anything about this. Maybe it was an AUX system or AIX or whatever Apple called their thing, their Unix boxes. I have no idea. I presumably it's some sort of Unix flavored thingy. I don't know. I never even counted this before. I suddenly just saw an 8.5-inch reel by Apple, which seemed rare enough. And then it's part of Operation Dalicious. I'm like, what? Okay. And it's the CA Apple DAL program, whatever that is. So anyway, if somebody needs this one last piece of the puzzle to complete their DAL setup for display at next year's Kansas Fest, then it's for sale on eBay right now for buy it now, $50.
Excellent.
Run, don't walk.
Well, I've got the next one, and it is also an old computer language. It's Microsoft Fortran. And these come up pretty frequently on eBay, but because we were talking about old languages, I decided I'd go with this one. I would really like to have one of these. I'll explain. This is like the slightly older style, but not the oldest style of the Microsoft language binders. This is the series of languages that they had kind of a off-green color and big book, you know, like 8.5 by 11 software binder, and within it you had all of your 5.25-inch floppy disks and your language reference manual. And I thought these looked really nice back in the day on a bookshelf. They were nice and, you know, like complete, very easy to take off the shelf and use. And this is when you still did get things like printed manuals and media and stuff like that for your software. This is the MS-DOS version. If you look at older versions of Microsoft Fortran, which there was one of those on eBay as well, you might be looking at something for CPM. In fact, I think there was even a CPM version on there that had an 8-inch floppy disk, which was kind of cool. But I actually like the look of the manuals better for these. After this, they went to the more traditional Microsoft white box manuals, if you guys remember those, with kind of the slide-in binders and paperback books within those, before they got rid of books entirely. This was probably my favorite iteration of the Microsoft languages in terms of just visually.
I think of Fortran as a punch card language. They talk about an old language. Fortran, I think dates back to the 50s or something, but it was around forever. I mean, Fortran 77 is one of the famous ones, so clearly stuck around to the 70s. But I just, in my mind, and I dabbled a bit and did some stuff in Fortran, like in school, we learned it. But I think of Fortran as something that you use punch cards with. I got this bias in my mind.
Well, when I learned Fortran, it was on punch cards. So you're right. But
so there you go. But it wasn't limited to that. Like Fortran stuck around for ages. I think, in fact, wasn't there eventually like a Fortran 90 or something like that? I'm pretty sure.
I think you're right about that.
There are some people who like it for number crunching still. And you can, if you're writing a software in C, you can link it with Fortran. Like, it all can, like, work together and stuff. So, apparently, and I don't know this in detail, but I remember a friend of mine who is a mathematician and, like, has worked in a variety of fields. And he said that just this, that he'd like to use Fortran for certain things because it had some things that were nice. If you want to express mathematical models, it was more capable in some ways than something like C was. And it had like automatic concurrency, so it could like, or parallelization, so you could, if you had many CPU cores and you're performing operations on huge arrays of things together, it would automatically shop those things out to all the CPUs, which is something that, like, Apple has APIs for that, and probably Microsoft does too, but there are, like, it's nice to have a language where it's sort of built into the language rather than
Yeah, I'm reading about it now. You're right. It's got like a do concurrent construct and stuff, and very cool. Wow. Yep. And when Fortran 2018 is the latest revision to it. Ooh, oh my goodness. It's neat that they name them after the year every time.
Yeah.
It's kind of quaint. Wow. So it is totally a current living language. I completely thought of this as something like that would be in the past. Wow. Yep. I'm out of the Fortran loop, as they say.
Still around.
Neat.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what the status of it was these days, because a few years ago when I'd looked into it, I'd seen things similar to what you guys are looking at right now, that in scientific communities and other niche applications that are very based in mathematics, that it was still very popular. I had thought that some of the math libraries and capabilities of more modern languages were beginning to edge it out, but it sounds like it's still, like, right in there with modern-day iterations and everything. That is very cool.
Hmm. And this one that you've picked on eBay for Microsoft is neat because it's a full compiler, so it'll compile down to a proper compiled binary. So that's cool. It's not an interpretive version. And I agree, like, these are nice, like, presentation binders. Like, it's a neat look, and this kind of binder is great for manual because everything lays flat. Mm-hmm. I don't like things with a spine if it's going to be a programming reference manual, like, totally useless. So we had talked last time about how things are nicer if they're comb bound or spiral bound or something. And in this case, like a big chunky binder is a great way to be able to have your pages lay completely flat in front of you as you're trying to muddle through a program. So nice. I dig it. I like the look of it.
Boy, yeah, that's so true about the spiral bound or the loose leaf bound versus the, you know, more typical paper
perfect
bound.
Binding.
Like,
yeah.
Like, because I remember when DBase 3 went, one of their iterations, I can't remember if it's when they went to version 1.1, but they made the switch from the loose leaf bound to the paperback book kind of thing. And it's almost useless. I mean, you're sitting there, you know, basically holding it down with one hand while you're trying to type with the other hand. It's just a nightmare. Yeah, I like these, you know. And one of the things I like, this is $199, buy it now, but they have a make offer. So I'm more willing to bring up an auction, even if the price seems a little out of line, when they have a make offer, because they're saying, you know, this is what I'd really like, but hey, let's talk. Whereas if it's like, you know, $300 for this and no make offer, then that's a bummer.
That's a bummer.
Well, I think that's it. Have we pretty much covered it? Wow, we're almost record time here, I think.
Yeah, that'll show, Paul. That's how you do a show.
Boom, boom, boom.
Oh, my. So we should go to closing discussions. Let's land the plane. Carrington, what you got to close us out here?
Well, speaking of boom, 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 and boom boxes and such, this is out of the retro computer, the oeuvre or whatever, but super fun. So Vox, the magazine website, I don't know what the heck Vox is, but there's a lady named Estelle Caswell, who I've seen a few of her videos, and she makes these amazing videos about hip-hop and rap and kind of looking into esoteric things about it. And I'm not into that kind of stuff at all. But if you think like Sony boomboxes, you can throw your cassette in. What are you going to listen to? You're going to listen to old school hip-hop, of course. And there's a great video, fascinating video, but why do rappers love Grey Poupon? And so it's just like, you wouldn't think this is as good as it is, but I promise you it is like a 10-minute long video and it's fascinating and interesting and funny start to finish. So she looks into the number of times Grey Poupon is mentioned, from like the first earliest mention she could find, which came right after that initial commercial where the guy would pull up in the limo, do you have any Grey Poupon, up to like the current day. And then it kind of investigates why in something like 2010 was there a massive spike in Grey Poupon usage, and why is it mentioned in like a Swedish rap song when it's not even sold in Sweden, like that kind of, it's so fascinating how she kind of looks into little threads and how they'll go through hip hop and rap music. And so this is an example of one of the best of these sorts of videos. So if our talk about cassette boomboxes has wet your whistle for some old school rap things, totally spend 10 minutes and watch this video about Grey Poupon and why rappers mention it and love it. And they have some theories about it. And it's just, it's great. So really, really good. Highly recommended. And the other thing I have to say is I missed Kansas Fest this year. And it's the first year in ages that I haven't gone to Kansas Fest. And I missed it so much. And being on the outside of it, now I was one of those people who would just watch they do like streaming videos, so I could put them on in the background, and it's kind of neat to be like just hanging out as the stream video. So I really appreciated it. And it's totally not the same as being there. I have often said that having streaming video, having like photos, having lots of stuff out there for people that don't attend wouldn't in any way make somebody think, oh, I don't need to go because I have the stream. And now I've seen it from both sides, and watching the streams is not remotely like being there. All it did was make me miss it more and want to be there. So I strongly do feel like the video streams are just a promotional thing and a great way to archive the sessions. And I really appreciated that they existed. So I'm glad that the K-Fest committee goes to that extent, like seeing, you know, Dr. Steve, like, set up the video and have the stream go. And yeah, it's not great sound and it's not great video. And since the contrast is so bad, like, often you can see the speaker, but their slides or whatever are just blown out. It's a big white rectangle behind them. So it's like, I wonder what that shows. But still, just like, I really appreciated that those existed. So I think they're great for archiving the event, but also great for people that either can't go or choose not to go or whatever. And so I really appreciate it. So it's one of those times where every time I've gone to Kansas Fest, I've just been filled with appreciation that people who are way less lazy than me actually spend all this time and energy to put on this amazing event. And this time not going, I was filled with that same appreciation. Like, there's people put on Kansas Fest, people like Paul, who are not here today because he's, you know, running Kansas Fest. The amount of effort it takes to run a show like that is incredible. And I was appreciative being up here in Toronto that they were also going to the effort of making things like streams available. So just wanted to say, give kind of a shout out to the K-Fest committee as a guy who didn't attend this year, that I still appreciated what they did. It makes me want to go all the more again in the future at some point.
Well said.
Cool.
That's what I got. And also Grey Poupon.
Bring your own Grey Poupon.
Of course. My ketchup chips or whatever. Whatever Canadians are known for. My ketchup chips and my apologies.
What about you, Jack? Any closing remarks?
I don't really have too much going on.
Yeah, Jack, what's your deal?
What is my deal? No, I wasn't going to say that. I was going to say I did actually just, right before we started, I saw a thingamajiggy from Retro Gathering, this thing here in Sweden that's a couple times a year, and we'll add this to the list later, but they also do have an upcoming show, one of their biannual things, at the end of September in Västerås, just about an hour train ride west of Stockholm. And I've been there a number of times, and I've always thought it was pretty fun, so anybody who's around should go, but I'll add that to the upcoming show list for the future.
Cool.
Well, I guess the only thing I've got to talk about is a techno nerdy thing, which I think I'm on the right podcast for that, right? So you guys have probably heard of Adafruit, the company that makes all the cool electronic gadgets and nice educational videos for them. And they're awesome. So I found out they have this cool thing called an AdaBox, which is a 4 times a year subscription where they curate and send you a box full of goodies, and the goodies will be of a particular theme. You know, there will be some motive in their madness in terms of what they send you. It's not just like a random bunch of parts. It's a bunch of stuff that all goes together, but at a decent price and with some extra collectibles in there, like either some stickers or this or that, that you can't get other than doing it through the subscription. So it's $60 per quarter to get this. You don't know what's coming. You just know that, like, the next one is September. So I'm waiting for September, and I'll get shipped this cool box of goodies that go together from Adafruit, and then I can make fun projects, and I don't have to sit around going, what should I make today? You know, what would be fun? They send you the fun, and then you can just have the fun. So I'm really excited about that. So I'll let you guys know in September what I wind up getting. But, you know, I looked at some of the past Ada boxes that they had shipped out. And it's really some awesome stuff, you know, combining displays with some sensors, with some microcontrollers, some other, you know, pieces that make it all go together. Maybe a case, like an acrylic case or something like that. It looked great. And one of the things that Adafruit does is weekly, they do a show and tell where they just have people come on with stuff that they bought from Adafruit and, you know, maker kind of activities that they've put together with Adafruit stuff. And they do it on, I think, Google Hangouts. Really fun to watch every week to see what kind of gadgets people are putting together. And some of them have been the stuff that you might get in one of these Ada boxes. So anyway, I'll let you guys know, but I'm excited. It's like, you know, Christmas four times
a year. That looks really, really cool.
Mm-hmm. That is exciting. I have a quick question for you about the name of the company. I thought, and this is not me saying it's right, because I just, one of those, you read it so you make assumptions, never saying it out loud. I assumed it was Adafruit, like the fruit of Ada Lovelace. Like it's, when I'm making up headcanon, in my mind it was Adafruit because it was Ada Lovelace.
Well, I think it's Ada, and I think they actually, I think she calls herself Lady Ada also.
Who calls herself Lady?
The head of Adafruit, the one
And is it Ada Lovelace or Ada Lovelace?
I think it's Ada.
I always go
with
Ada.
My goodness. Okay. In my mind, I've pronounced all of this wrong always. I often do that. You know, it's the thing everybody says. It's not bad to pronounce a word if you pronounce it because that's how you read it only. I think... Now I don't even know how I say it.
This is another Abby books, isn't it?
I say it with a soft G.
I think it's Ada. Yeah,
probably.
I think so.
Cool.
You can go watch one of the videos. They introduce
speaking of people that should be put on money.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
The Lovelace on all the money.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, guys, I think we've exhausted all of our topics, sadly. So I will now bring us to a close. That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can find us over in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php, PHP being one of those old languages that we still program in. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can also join our Facebook group, which I think at this point has like a million. Wasn't it about a million people in there? Or anyway.
But just not in base 10.
Yeah.
It's a million in binary.
Oh, your wit, Carrington. It is unrivaled. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We're a member of the Throwback Network, which is at throwbackreviews.com/a-bunch-of-stuff. If you want the link, it's in the show notes. You can write a review for us on iTunes. We would very much appreciate it. And until next time,
Retro Compute.